Welcome to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. Do the Istanbul talks serve any purpose now? Why does the West want the conflict to continue? Also, Operation Spiderweb, with U.S. involvement, is a major escalation against Russia. And does Russia's SMO now include anti-terrorism? To discuss these issues and more, I'm joined by my guest, George Samueli in Budapest. He's a podcaster at The Gaggle, which can be found on YouTube and Locals. And here in Moscow, we cross to Mark Sloboda. He is an international relations and security analyst. All right, gentlemen, crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. All right, let's just kick it off with Mark here in Moscow. Over the last week, Mark, what has changed? Has everything changed? And did spiderweb backfire? Thoughts?
So that's a good way of phrasing it. In a nutshell, everything has changed and nothing has changed. With regards to the Istanbul process, it is my opinion that it never served any useful purpose, and it certainly doesn't serve any useful purpose now, with everyone signaling, whether we're talking Kiev or Moscow, the Europeans, which were never interested, most of the Donald Trump administration, other than maybe Donald Trump, everyone is ready to throw in the towel and walk away from this pantomime theater. The big thing to come out of the last week is escalation. Escalation on the battlefield and escalation in the field of long-range strikes and asymmetric warfare. This war is not going to end anytime soon. It is going to get nastier and bloodier.
Well, you know, George, I usually don't pat ourselves on the back, at least on air, but I can remember after the election of last year in November and the incoming Trump administration, quite a number of very notable voices. I'm not going to mention them here. It's not important. But you and I said escalation is most likely going to happen, not de-escalation, not a peace process, but an expansion of the conflict. I think we have been vindicated in that assessment, George.
I think so. I think, to be fair, I think Trump did initially think in terms of bringing this to an end. And I think we did predict that as well, that Trump will make some kind of an effort simply because he had promised during the campaign that, well, if he doesn't end it on day one, he will end it. He through his own charm and energy and dynamism, he will end it. But now it's becoming clear that he doesn't really know how to end this, and he's unwilling to do what he seemed ready to do, at least in the early part of the administration, which was to start applying pressure on Kiev. And so he's now in a situation where which is what he said when he was meeting with Chancellor Merz the other day, is, well, let's let this fighting continue. You know, he used this analogy of two children in the park, and they're just fighting, they can't stop beating each other up. And he said, well, it's probably better not to interrupt them. And then after a while, we can come in. What exactly he means by that, after a while, we can come in, you know, he left that fairly vague. But he didn't, so far, he hasn't yet endorsed the escalation of the sanctions regime. He said, well, I'm going to have to look at it. This is the Lindsey Graham legislation, and you know, maybe I'll throw my weight behind it, but ultimately nothing is going to happen unless I support it, and at the moment I don't support it.
Well, I think he's essentially given up, and if he's going to weigh in any further, it's for his own reputation and not to end the conflict. You know, Mark, what's interesting, I think so many analysts have not taken into consideration looking at the attack last weekend on Russia's nuclear triad, is this is just a continuation of decades of shattering arms control agreements. I mean, we shouldn't be surprised. I guess the only thing that's different is they used a proxy. They used Ukraine to do this. But this is an ongoing process of having no arms control whatsoever, which makes the world a very, very dangerous place. Mark.
Yes. First of all, I would have to say that with Donald Trump's facile and offensive analogy to the conflict in Ukraine being two children that you want to separate, I've got another analogy. So there's two kids on a playground. One is quite a bit bigger than the other. And Donald Trump comes up behind the little one and swats the bigger kid in the back of the head himself, and then turns around and tries to whistle and pretend like he has nothing to do with it. And then says, hey, why are you kids fighting? You shouldn't be fighting, right? And then occasionally takes another swat in on the fight on behalf of goading the little kid into getting the snot beat out of him by the bigger kid. Because that's really the case. The U.S. is the proxy master of this conflict. It was Donald Trump that first gave lethal weapons to the Kiev regime, which he proudly brags about at every opportunity. It was Donald Trump's administration that just provided the absolutely essential satellite information that was necessary for the Kiev regime to carry out this asymmetric attack on Russia's strategic assets, that part of their nuclear triad. And it's Donald Trump's intelligence during the 4 years of his presidency that took over and recreated the Kiev regime's intelligence that was used as the proxy to carry out this attack on Russia. So Donald Trump is up to his gills. This is his war, and he can't pretend otherwise. With respect to the nuclear triad, this is crossing a red line of red lines. This already happened a year ago when Russia's early warning radars in Voronezh were attacked. And now there are lots of people crowded around the president telling him that Russia's changes to their nuclear use doctrine that were enacted, basically saying that Russia would strike back against any nuclear power that was using a proxy to take attacks at them. There's a lot of people telling Putin that he has to respond extremely forcefully to this. I don't think that he is going to resort to nukes, but I would be very surprised if we don't see Oreshniks flying in the next week.
Yeah, and you know, George, I think it's already started without a lot of fanfare. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, again, you know, I've mentioned these Telegram channels, and I take them all with a grain of salt, but there's certainly a lot of imagery out there in video about heightened activity, Russian activity striking Ukraine. So I think we've already seen, and it's just going to go up the escalation ladder, as we have talked about. You know, in response to what Mark just said, it's interesting, you know, we have the Trump administration, which I think Mark is absolutely correct. But is Trump in the loop? That's a question.
Well, that is a very good question, and we really don't know. I mean, the close analogy, I think, is with you know, Dwight D. Eisenhower and the resumption of the U-2 spy plane flights in the late 1950s. Eisenhower had given his pledge to Khrushchev that, in the spirit of this new detente that had developed, that he was going to terminate the U-2 spy flights over the Soviet Union. And then, lo and behold, just on the eve of the big summit in Paris in 1960, the United States resumed the spy flights, and one of those U-2 planes was shot down by the Soviets. And of course, Khrushchev was livid about it, and he essentially torpedoed the Paris summit. It's very likely, it's almost certain, in fact, that Eisenhower did not know about this. This was done by the U.S. Air Force, that they had undertaken this, and with a view, obviously, to achieving the result that it achieved, which was to torpedo the summit. And then there's clearly, within the administration, very powerful forces, both at the level of the deep state, the people who operate the intelligence and military infrastructure, and at the highest level, they want to keep this war going. And there is obviously the enormous pressure that is coming from NATO, all the NATO leaders, And then they keep, you know, berating Trump that he's got to get with the program, keep doing this, do more and more. And we saw this very much during this summit with Chancellor Merz. Merz came along and said, well, you know, this is June the 6th. This is, you know, remember June the 6th. This was when the United States came and liberated the continent from the, you know, the horrible Nazis, with his obvious analogies that the Russians are the Nazis. And said, well, you know, this is what you need to do, what the Americans did on June the 6th, 1944. Of course, conveniently forgetting the role of the Russians and the Red Army. But yeah, that's it. So that's this constant pressure that is coming on Trump. Very hard to break out of all of it.
Yeah, well, Merz was the last guy to bring up June 6th. It just didn't work. That whole conversation was a failure at cross purposes. It was a waste of time. Mark, this is called a plausible deniability. You know, George is an example of the U-2 flight. Fine. But it's not fine for the Russians. They can say, well, okay, you guys have your plausible deniability issue, but what about us? Okay, who do we trust? Do we trust Trump? Are there other people we should be talking to? I mean, I get the plausible deniability issue, but it doesn't, the side that it's targeted against, what are they supposed to think, Mark?
Yeah, I would rather call it implausible deniability. Right. Everyone knows what really happened, but they're going to maintain the fiction, the fig leaf of a proxy here. Look, just a week ago, Donald Trump tweeted out a mafia style threat tweet, or what do you call a
truth? Truth,
truth. Yeah, a truth, quote unquote, on Truth Social. You know, basically saying that Putin had better get in line with his demand for an unconditional ceasefire in Ukraine, because if it wasn't for him, very bad things would happen to Russia, right? And a week later, we have this attack. Now, the attack was much less damaging than the Kiev regime's propaganda put out first. And even U.S. intelligence has walked it down by a quarter. It certainly hasn't impacted Russia's ability to carry out the SMO at all. And very minimal and temporary damage was done to, Russia's strategic Tupolev 95 bomber fleet. But they know very well that the United States was behind this attack, that this was an escalate to de-escalate situation. And once again, the U.S. was left with another escalation, not giving the results. Remember, this occurred in a day of attacks on the Crimean Bridge, a terrorist attack on a civilian train crossing another bridge.
And the day before the resumption of the Istanbul talks,
right? And right now, Russia and the Kiev regime.
Okay, Mark, I'm going to let you finish your thought, but after the break, gentlemen, and I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a break, and after that break, we'll continue our discussion of some real news. Stay with RT.
The Russian state-controlled narrative.
Als Teil der Sanktionen gegen Russland gehen die westlichen Länder gegen russische Auslandssender vor.
Mais écoutez, monsieur, c'est pas à vous de décider de qui est journaliste ou pas dans ce pays. On est en France, quoi. C'est pas possible.
We will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine. The state-owned Russia Today and Sputnik.
RT, Sputnik, even our video agency, roughly all banned on YouTube.
Et merci à vous tous pour votre fidélité et votre soutien.
Welcome back to Crosstalk Bullhorns, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle Trenge. We're discussing some real news. All right, Mark, I want to go back to you before I went to the break. I kind of want to move it a little bit forward. I think we're all in agreement that the Istanbul process 2.0 version is a dead letter right now. We have to remind everyone that the Russians were essentially picking up where they left off in negotiations in 2022 with the changes of the facts on the ground. That is something that was untenable for NATO and the United States. We don't know what Trump's position on that is one way or another. So where do we go now? I mean, obviously, if you parse the words that came out of the Kremlin last week or so, there seems to be, and correct me if I'm wrong, but there seems to be a differentiation between the SMO and an anti-terrorist campaign. Am I right? Or because I think they were talking about separate issues. They were looking at the collapsed bridges, but then they didn't talk, let's be honest, not at great length of what happened with the faraway bases inside of Russia. Is there a differentiation going on?
Yeah, I think there is a very strong consideration. And let's point out, an attack on a bridge like in Bryansk that is used for military as well as civilian purposes is a legitimate military target. A bridge with a civilian passenger train going over it at the time it went off is not a legitimate military target. It is an act of terror and a war crime. That's why the Russian government has been talking very much. President Putin himself has started to compare the Kiev regime to a terrorist organization. And if Russia reclassifies the special military operation, the intervention, as a counter-terror operation, as they seem to at least be considering, that actually has very big legal implications in Russia and for what the military can and can't do. One big thing it would change would mean that the Russian military was now able to carry out strikes targeting the Kiev regime's political leadership, holding them accountable for these acts of terror against Russian civilians. So that's a possibility. But there's also, you know, Russia, where it goes is to the battlefield. And Russia is steamrolling on the battlefield. And above the battlefield, both sides are trading hundreds of drones, long-range strike drones, and on the Russian side, missiles as well, on a nightly basis. The big difference is that Russia's drones carry a much bigger payload, are much more effective, and Russia has a very powerful air defense and electronic warfare system, and the Kiev regime has none left. That means that the long-range strike nightly blows exchanged is very, very much in Russia's favor as well.
So, but George, the Ukraine regime, the Kiev regime, and its Western allies want all of this to continue. How do you make sense of that in light of what Mark just said?
It's very difficult to make sense of it. One has to assume that, and this is really being primarily now driven by the Europeans, is that the Europeans want to step up a war economy and the war regime on the continent, and you know, you've seen all sorts of indications of this. You had the Keir Starmer's defense review that came out the other day, essentially, where we're now preparing for a war with Russia. You see this with Macron, with all the talk about, you know, getting directly involved in Ukraine, and then you see it in the language used by the European Union leaders like Ursula von der Leyen, who are really advocating censorship, introduction of censorship now, you know, the sort of, you're going from debunking to pre-bunking. So that, in other words, we create these new AI systems that prevent the transmission of news and information that we in the EU do not want to see and hear. So I think that there's this natural authoritarianism within the EU is really coming out there. I mean, we saw kind of a trial run of this at COVID, but I think this is going to be much more intense. And I think they want to use this war in Ukraine and the sort of the Russophobia, the sort of whipping up terror. You know, and you see this daily in the media, this terror about, you know, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. There's an article in the Politico today, Germany's building up its bunkers, you know, the underground bunkers, you know, in preparation for this Russian attack. So I think there's this desire to impose this authoritarian.
I think it's I think it's more the latter. I think it's far more political. I think it's far more domestic within the EU than it is preparing for war with Russia. Well, Mark, since we're bringing up analogies here, it seems like to me, you know, we have Ukraine. It's drowning in a sea. The EU, the Europeans come up in their boat and say, "Oh my goodness, you're drowning. We're going to go back to port and get a life raft." Okay, we'll be as back as soon as we possibly can. Okay, as the currents keep pulling, you know, Ukraine deeper and deeper into. I mean, the reason why I'm bringing this up is that I don't see all this fear mongering, war mongering. Helping Ukraine now, okay? I mean, and who knows what it's going to, you know, in 5 years or 10, who knows what's going to happen in 5 months, in 5 weeks, okay? That's why I don't understand this, Mark.
Yeah, you're right. And I think George is right that it's about terror, but terror both within and without. The Europeans' plan is to do whatever they can to keep the Kiev regime fighting in whatever capacity it can for another 5 years while they have a fantasy of restarting a military-industrial complex. And maybe there'll be a change of leadership by that time, more to their favor in the United States. And the way forward for the Kiev regime was laid out in the pages of the Washington Post this week by David Ignatius. And this is something that I've actually been saying for a year. Asymmetric warfare, right? And David Ignatius termed it that Ukraine's, the Kiev regime's, dirty war has just begun. This is all going to be now about this type of asymmetric, unconventional warfare, assassinations, terrorist bombings.
Yeah, but Mark, how will that change the battle, the military conflict going on in Ukraine? Yeah, of course, you know, we saw this with Miss Dugina. We've seen this many, many times. But that, how does that change the calculus of the war?
It doesn't on the battlefield, right? It doesn't. But the goal has always been, whether it was with the sanctions or, you know, the attacks on the Crimean Bridge, everything is a narrative war. Their only hope is to provoke some type of political crisis within Russia. That has always been the plan from the beginning. It hasn't worked so far. It's unlikely to work. In fact, it will probably achieve, you know, the opposite result. But you can't convince the European political and military elite that continuing to bang their head against the wall is, you know, not going to change things, right? They cannot be convinced otherwise. They can't believe they are losing this war to Russia.
Why can't they believe that, Mark? Why can't
they? Because their identity, their sense of Western exceptionalism is tied up in this. They believe they are morally, structurally, and societally superior to Russia, and they just can't accept losing to Russia in this conflict.
George, your thoughts?
No, I agree with Mark, and I think that what David Ignatius wrote in that column in the Washington Post is very instructive. I mean, David Ignatius is essentially a mouthpiece for the CIA. So this is CIA thinking. And what they're advocating here is asymmetric warfare. I mean, and that's what Ignatius, I mean, he was advocating.
Okay, but George, asymmetric, that's attacks on civilians. Yes.
It's attack on targets. You know, assassinations, bombings, attacks on cargo ships, attacks on ports, attacks in Africa where Russian mercenaries fighting. So everywhere, and this obviously, they're getting assistance from the CIA. Ukraine doesn't have the resources to conduct this kind of global sabotage terror campaign. But the idea is definitely either provoke a crisis within Russia, and that is clearly their goal. You know, the goal, I think, is to force Putin to mobilize. And then they think if he mobilizes, this will be so unpopular within Russia that, you know, his government will fall. That's one scenario. And then the other scenario is to provoke a crisis within Europe in such a way that it'll seem like Russia is attacking a NATO member state. Article 5 goes into operation. Finally, the moment has arrived. We're at war with Russia. And there is a sense of, let's call it pre-1914, where, you know, people being whipped up into this fervor, war fervor, until finally...
Yeah, but, you know, the problem is...
That's it. Finally, we've got our war.
Yeah, I think that's an elite fantasy. I don't see populations in Europe say, I want to sign up and go die in the Don. I don't know. That's not real.
Populations may not, but mercenaries might.
Well, I mean, if Merz wants to put on a uniform, go right ahead. Go right ahead. Mark, asymmetrical. You know, we've seen in my mind, the illegitimate president of Ukraine flying all over the world, you know, to luncheons and meetings and all of that. The airport's open. They're at war. Asymmetrical. Shut that down. Shut him down.
Yeah. I mean, if they continue this style, this asymmetric, unconventional warfare, dirty tricks, whatever you want to call it, and Russia reclassifies this as a counter-terror operation and begins targeting him and his political leadership, his days of gallivanting most of the time around the world with his beggar's cup in hand could very well come to an end. At the end of the day, Russia has not targeted Zelensky or his immediate clique in the Kiev regime up till now, basically because they considered them so incompetent that replacing them with anyone else would have only been an improvement in the Kiev regime, so it wasn't to their interests. Now they may have, arrived at a different calculation if the attacks that at least in part target Russian civilians, this type of dirty war that David Ignatius is obviously proudly presenting as the path forward, that calculus may very well change in the Kremlin, and Zelensky's day of playing, you know, global Western poster child may be over.
Yeah, and what might also be over is Trump's bid to end the conflict. We have, gentlemen, as the summer proceeds, we have the issue with Iran. If the Iranian leadership looking at the ineffectiveness of Trump, why should they deal with him? The implications of all of this are immense. Unfortunately, we won't be able to discuss it here and now. I want to thank my guests in Moscow and in Budapest. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time. Remember, crosstalk rules. We'll be right back.